Dr. Google can't fix your knee. The Joint Relief Institute can. Fast joint pain relief, covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
If you can't tell, is a Beatles song. It's from a new CD that I just discovered, a guy named Milos, who is a classical guitarist. The album is called Blackbird, the Beatles album, and it's fantastic. Welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. Life is, I've always thought, a series of chapters, and the most interesting among us on this planet have a lot of chapters in their lives. The latest chapter in the life of John Shulian, legendary sports writer, television success, newspaper man, is novelist. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
It's a pleasure. And the great thing is I've decided only to do hour-long interviews because I think people can get a better sense of the person and the work. So you are going to be on for an entire hour. The novel is called A Better Goodbye, and I certainly will talk at length about this book because I loved this book, as did many of the people reviewing this book. Why this new chapter, John? How did this book come to be? You are, and happy birthday, 71 years old today.
Well, thank you.
You seem younger. You seem eternally youthful to me.
Yes, but it's maybe 69. Yeah. I wrote the first draft of this novel in 2004.
Okay.
And then went off to teach at my alma mater, the University of Utah, for a semester. Came back, got some notes from some people I trusted as readers, revised it again, found an agent, a wonderful old-time agent named Sterling Lord.
He was Mike Royko's agent.
Yes,
did you know that? Yeah.
Jack Kerouac's agent.
Yes.
Jimmy Breslin's agent. He was everybody's agent. He was like a bus station you went through on your way to the book business.
I'm glad to hear he's still around, for God's sake.
He's in his 90s. I don't, you know, when I talked to him, he was just a boy of 92 or something like that. And very vigorous and playing tennis every day and divorcing his wife because she didn't want to have sex as often as he did. And he was a character.
Well, that gives us both something to look forward to. That sounds like a perfect life for a 92-year-old. And he was able to sell
anyway,
this.
But we couldn't get the book set up anywhere. And so it sort of went into a pile on my desk. And then I was editing a collection of boxing journalism with my friend George Kimball, a book called At the Fights that we did for the Library of America. And we were represented by George's literary agent, a really bright young guy who went to McAllister up in St. Paul and studied under a friend of mine. And Farley Chase is his name, and Farley did a great job on the boxing book for us. And so I said, you know, would you mind taking a look at this novel I've written? And he read it and liked it and began his own campaign and did a splendid job of finding targets. And one of the targets he found for the book was a guy named Jerry Howard. And Jerry Howard is probably one of the five or six most highly regarded book editors in New York.
Hmm.
He was David Foster Wallace's editor.
Oh, wow.
And
wow.
He's a Thomas Pynchon expert, and you can read long essays about Pynchon that Jerry Howard has written. And he really liked what I had done, with one exception, and that is that my protagonist, Nick Pasco, a boxer whose career ended when he
hurt somebody in the ring. That is the
killed
beginning.
Killed a man in the ring.
Yeah, and the beginning of chapter 5, yeah.
And he said, you know, Nick is too mopey. He drags the book down. And, you know, I really made this guy. Job was a piker compared to Nick Pasco.
Yeah,
In the early in the early stages of this novel. And so, based on one note, I rewrote a third of the book.
Wow. Wow.
And I think that there's a lesson there that it's not quantity, it's quality.
Yeah. But also, I mean, the lesson, you know,
Hollywood, and I've gotten notes from people. You sit in these endless story meetings, and they pick your script apart or your story apart. And here was a guy who just cut right to the bone.
What a treat, because you and I have both, over the years, worked for a lot of newspaper editors, some of them very good and some of them idiots. But it is, at best, I have always thought of writing as a collaborative kind of effort, and obviously that's what's going on with A Better Goodbye, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. You know, I was with Jerry Howard, who I never have met. I never met with him, never talked to him on the phone. Everything was done through my agent. And so I rewrote the book, and I also got a professional reader, a woman named Kathy Tomlinson, to read the book. And she had read screenplays and novels for friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And her notes were wonderful because she was hard-boiled. You know, I'm kind of soft-boiled at heart. And the greatest note she gave was, there was some line of dialogue that she didn't like, and she said, "Nick sounds like a weenie here." I thought, now there's a keeper. That's a great note.
You know, John, and I'm talking to John Shulian about his new career as a novelist, and the novel's A Better Goodbye. It is, for lack of a better definition, it is a Los Angeles noir, but it's more than that. You have done, John, you're one of the most accomplished writers I know. Any insecurity when writing a novel, or had you been fooling around with fiction your entire career?
No, when I walked away from the wreckage of my TV career, I was looking for things to do. And I wrote a couple short stories. I wrote one that appeared on a very good crime fiction blog called Thug Lit, which is terrific. A lot of very accomplished crime writers have their work appear there. And that was a hard-boiled story about Christmas in L.A. and a detective and a woman who he either couldn't trust. And it was great fun to write. And then I wrote another short story that got in the Prague Review. A story about a country singer and a kid who was hitchhiking after his romance broke up in Dallas, and he was hitchhiking back to a state that was not named, but was probably Utah.
Wow. Well, I get the sense from A Better Goodbye, which is a terrific, terrific book, that you had a great deal of fun writing this. I'm talking with John Shulian for this entire hour, and when we come back from a short, and I do mean short, commercial break, John and I are going to talk about his newspaper career, because he and I, at the advanced age, are, you know, it's kind of the last of a generation, John, who knew newspapers when newspapers still had a glint of that front page kind of era, and now we are going to live through whatever it is newspapers are going to become. So stay tuned and listen to John Shulian talk about that. It'll be just a couple of minutes. Listening to an instrumental guitarist, a classical guitarist, play the Beatles. My guest for this entire hour is John Shulian, and I never have had John on the show when I did not remind you listeners of what a great sports columnist he was when he was in Chicago. John, I'm going to read that famous paragraph, the paragraph that haunts me to this day. Here is John Shulian writing in the Sun-Times in 1981, this column about Skip Dillard and Bernard Randolph, these star-crossed, if you remember, local hoops legends. Quote, "Even in the loving glow of noonday sunshine, with March pretending it's May and the thermometer skipping toward 60, K-Town has trouble wiping the sorrow from its face. On the west side streets that gave birth to the neighborhood's name, on Kedvale and Keeler and the half dozen others, there are too many boarded up windows, too many burned out houses, too many cars with flat tires or no tires at all. Stray dogs wander listlessly, ragged men kill time with bottles in brown bags, and the only sign of hope is a bouncing basketball. You are and remain a terrific writer. I will read a couple excerpts from A Better Goodbye. John, what was it in the first place that drew you into the world of newspapers?
It was probably because writing was the only thing I could do. I didn't have the courage to try fiction when I was young, and I always looked at newspapering as my ticket to life. That if I had a press pass or a reporter's notebook, I could go anywhere. When I started my first job out of the Army, was at the Baltimore Evening Sun, and I spent 5 years on the city desk there, and I covered fires and shootings and political corruption, and wrote about local characters. Baltimore actually had a singing newsboy in those days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there was a rabbi's son who was a racetrack tout, and we had all the John Waters characters. And I wrote a once-a-week rock and roll column. And I just had the best time ever. How great is this? And then I wrote a piece for Sports Illustrated about a fight promoter in Baltimore who had a gym above a strip joint.
Mm.
And that changed my life and my career path entirely. The Washington Post, the editors there saw the piece and liked it and hired me as a sports writer.
Well, you were lured to Chicago in the last gasp of the glory days of the Chicago Daily News, when its editor, Jim Hoag, started to hire some grand talent from around the country and me from here. What lured you to Chicago? I can only imagine, but I'd like to hear it from you.
Well, Chicago is a great sports town. It's a great city. And I was not wild about Washington, D.C. I mean, it was fine if you were a lobbyist or something.
Right.
Congressional aide, but I didn't have any pinstripe suits from Brooks Brothers. I didn't really fit in. And I wanted to be a columnist.
Yeah.
And I had only been at the Post for 18 months when Jim Hoag said, "Hey, look, I don't have a lot of time, but do you want to share a cab with me out to National Airport?"
Is that right?
And we got in the back seat of the cab, and I sent him some clips. And there on January 31st, 1977, I was a sports columnist at the Chicago Daily News.
Wow, that was the same year I was hired at the News, too, which it was a grand staff, and sadly, about a year and a few months later, the paper folded. You went immediately, as did I, after some screwing around, to the Sun-Times. It's very funny. You had a great impact here. There was a piece, you know, of course, like a million pieces about the Bears and their Super Bowl victory in 86. And I'll tell you, did you read this or hear about this? Mike McCaskey says, talking to the reporter, he says, "I remember a column in the Sun-Times by John Shulian, and the headline on the column was, 'Hiring Ditka would be madness,' said a laughing McCaskey, whose grandfather, George Ellis, hired Ditka." In a way, it was a mistake, because that team, don't you think, should have had more than one Super Bowl in them?
Absolutely. That was a team that was built to be a dynasty.
Yeah.
You know, they should have had a 4 or 5 year run. They just had wonderful talent and wonderful personalities.
No question.
I mean, that team was a writer's dream. You know, you got to watch one of the best football players ever in Walter Payton. One of the great defenses ever. They had just an abundance of talent. And Ditka did screw it up. And, obviously he had that one big year, so you have to give him credit for that.
Indeed.
But
do you find...
Believe me when I say that that headline and that column have been pointed out to me before.
But does it sometimes... I wrote a long magazine piece about Mike who I now understand is not drinking at all, which is a very, very good thing for his health and everybody around him. But does it fascinate you on any level, John Chulian, that Ditka is still this beloved, beloved icon here? I know he's still on TV and he's doing his, you know, the commentary every Sunday, but it really kind of amazes me that he remains this toweringly popular figure. I think he could, you know, he could arguably run for mayor if he felt like it.
Well, you may get a chance.
Yeah, no kidding. We may need one. Yeah, but is it just the dint of his personality? You know, he's not from Chicago. He wasn't born here. He's from Pennsylvania. Is it that he embodies this kind of, you know, Chicago tough spirit? How do you read this whole Ditka fascination?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it exactly, because, you know, it's the city of broad shoulders and all that stuff. And whoever had broader shoulders on a football field than Mike Ditka?
Yeah.
He used to catch a pass and then start looking for defensive backs he could run over. I mean, he was a wonderful football player. He was a thrilling football player. And he was a tough guy. He was everything that Chicago fancies itself as. Now, I think, you know, that may be changing. I don't spend enough time, anywhere near enough time in Chicago to be able to talk about the civic personality changing or anything.
Well, but also, John Chulian, it's also that in a place like L.A. or New York, that someone like Mike Ditka would have a considerably more competition for the public's attention. I mean, you have movie stars out there, for goodness sake. You would write so movingly, and I will ever remember your sense of the city in that paragraph I just read. When you finally left Chicago, and you left when Murdoch came, and many of us did, what did you wind up missing most about the sports scene here, John?
Just that, you know, the passion of the people. I would go to Sox Park. You know, if the Cubs, one of the great things about Chicago is if the Cubs were on the road, the White Sox were at home, and you had the whole American League to write about. So I'd go to Sox Park, write something about Bill Veeck or Lamar Hoyt or Carlton Fisk or whoever happened to be the hero or personality of the day. Then the Sox would go out of town, the Cubs would come back to Wrigley Field, I'd go to the north side, and inevitably there would be some fan in the box seat yelling, "Chulian, go back to the south side." You know, the people, and that was what made it so much fun. Newspapers were part of the fabric of everyday life in Chicago. People read them. They read them thoroughly. They knew who the writers were. We were all a bunch of idiots.
Yes, of course, yeah.
And that made it fun. You knew, you know, I was married then, and my wife would be on the L train to work in the morning, and she would say, "Gee, I saw all these people reading your column." And that made me feel good.
Yeah.
I really liked that.
Yeah, and that those days are sadly gone. They are gone. They are gone. I want to, when we come back now, I want to have talk about another chapter in your life, which was your, still ongoing, but your TV chapter, which I have often found so fascinating, and I think you have made every other journalist of our generation, you know, mildly jealous. It's like, hey, how come he got to write for, you know how that goes. How come he got to write for TV? I know a story about how you got in the world of TV, and I want you to either confirm that or say, that's so beautifully apocryphal, Rick. But I love it. So we'll talk about that after the news. I have John Chulian on for this entire hour. We are certainly going to get to, in a little more depth, his fantastic new novel, A Better Goodbye, which if some, you know, it is L.A.-based, and if some producer, has this book been optioned yet for movies?
No, I think it's massively available, as we say in the trade.
Well, you're going to get a nibble. We will be right back after the news with John Chulian. Thank you. Beatles instrumentally. Hi, Rick Hogan. After Hours is the show. John Shoyan is my guest for the next half hour. We are certainly going to talk at length about his first novel. His first novel. He turned 71 today, which means he wrote it before he was 70. It's called A Better Goodbye, and it is a, for lack of a better phrase, it's a noir, but it's got some of the most vibrant, if somewhat scary, characters that I have read in a, met in a book in a long time. John, the apocryphal story is that you sent a copy of your collected boxing writings to Stephen Bochco, saying, "Dear Mr. Bochco," who did a number of shows, including L.A. Law and Hill Street Blues, saying, "I would really like to become a screenwriter. Can you give me some advice?" Is that true at all?
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Really?
I turned 40 in Philadelphia and decided I didn't want to turn 41 there. and, you know, I was working at a paper with a really terrific sports section, the Philadelphia Daily News.
Oh, yeah.
And we had Pete Dexter up front as one of our local columnists, and he was fabulous. And Pete, of course, went on to become a really great American novelist.
No question.
But anyway, I wrote Stephen Bochco and said, you know, what are the chances of doing this? And he wrote back. We exchanged a couple letters. He sent me some Hill Street Blues scripts. And then he wrote back, and I have the letter framed and hanging on the wall in my office here at home. And he said, "Dear John Shulian, I'll be surprised and disappointed if you can't write for the screen. If I ever get this show about lawyers, God help me, off the ground, I'll have you write a script. For money, of course. P.S., you type great. I didn't spot a single do-over in your letter."
You know, that reminds me of the, it was, who was it? One of Ben Heck's friends, when he first went out to Hollywood, Herman Mankiewicz, sent a telegram to Ben Heck saying, "Hurry, you must get out here. The only competition is idiots, and there are millions to be made." How did you, the world of TV, I mean, you wrote for a number of different shows, then you created Xena the Warrior Princess, which at one time was the most syndicated show on TV. Did you like writing for television, John?
Well, I would have liked writing for television more if I'd been better at it. I think I've always been a prose guy primarily.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was wonderful because, you know, coming out here and having to learn a new business.
Sure.
And check my ego at the door.
Yep.
You know, I'm playing somebody else's game now, and it is no time for me to get high and mighty. It's time to say, "Yes, sir, no, sir, what can I do to serve you?"
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote a script for Stephen, and a quick story. He was taking a flyer on three people at that time. A young attorney from Boston named David Kelly, whose career worked out pretty well for him.
Oh, Lord, sure did.
And
plus, he married Michelle Pfeiffer. Plus, he married Michelle Pfeiffer, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, David Kelly was a golden child.
Yes.
And then I was the third member of this unholy trio, and Stephen had gotten the script in from the woman, and it was a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, I didn't want to waste his time and I didn't want to waste mine, what if I wrote five or six scenes from the story we had worked out? And there are probably, God, I don't know, 30 or 40 scenes in an episode of television, and I guess closer to 30. And so he said, "Yeah, fine." And so I gave him, like, worked like hell on him. I was staying at Mike Downey's apartment out in Marina Del Rey, another old Chicago Daily News guy. And I got them, I dropped them, the scenes off on Stephen's desk on a Friday afternoon. He said, he promised he'd read them. The next day I was out horsing around in L.A., and I came back, and the message light was blinking, and I picked it up and played the message, and it was Bochco, and he said, "I don't know what you're doing hanging around with sports writers, kid. You're in show business."
Oh, my God. What a great. That's even better than the story I had heard all these years. He must have been a fascinating guy to work for. And
he was so good to me. He really was. And I met a succession of people in Hollywood, starting with a Chicago native, actually a Highland Park native named Jeff Melvoin,
mm-hmm.
who were so gracious and supportive. And altogether wonderful. It was the exact opposite of what I
of the conventional wisdom. Sure, sure.
And Bochco, we liked each other. He knew how hard I worked on the script. My dad actually died in the middle of writing my script for L.A. Law.
Ugh.
And then I got through it, and I came back and I did a rewrite for him, and then he. I had made friends with a guy on staff, a guy named Jacob Epstein, and he was lobbying Stephen to hire me. And Bochco was much too wise for that because I didn't know television and I didn't know the law. I would have just been, a barnacle on the ship.
Yeah.
But he sent me over to Universal before I could get started to his mentor, a guy named Bill Sackheim. And before I could get something going with Bill Sackheim, Miami Vice called, and they were doing a two-parter about boxing.
Yeah.
And so I went over there, and I met Dick Wolf, who was running the writing staff. This is before he now went off and did L.A., or Law & Order, rather.
Yeah.
And Dick and I did the two scripts, and the next thing I knew, I was on staff at Miami Vice.
What
a
story.
So in the course of 6 months, Rick.
Yeah.
I had hopscotched past 2,000 writers I didn't even know were there.
Sure, sure. This story, I hope this story is an inspiration to those of you out there who may be trying it, because that is a tough racket, boy. As you probably know, John, better than anybody, that the whole screenwriting, teleplay writing racket is brutal. I mean, I know people who have written. Elliot Wald, another colleague of ours, went out there.
Oh, he's your friend, yeah.
And he sold a few things. And I guess he made a living doing, but it's a weird, weird world. Are you still part of that? I mean, do you think of developing shows or any of that jazz?
Well, if I do, I try to sit down and wait until the idea passes. I've pretty much been out of it, and without any tears shed.
Sure.
You know, I got my 20 years in. I have a wonderful pension. I have lifetime health care beyond what the government provides me. My life is good, and I owe it to TV.
Yeah.
And it really got me sane again. It helped me, even journalistically, in that... Well, when I started writing again, I was a better writer, not necessarily because TV made me a better writer, but because I was around smart people
mm-hmm.
who, from many different callings. A lot of TV is where a lot of people who get tired of another profession wash up.
No question.
Lots of lawyers work in this business,
yep.
Doctors, electrical engineers, professional golfers. I mean, I worked with them all.
Well, it is certainly, I find that a very interesting chapter, and I'm glad to hear it was so rewarding. I'm going to, before one more commercial break, and again, I appreciate you on your birthday. What are you doing for your birthday after this show? It's only 8 o'clock out there, right?
I had a very nice dinner last night with a lady friend, and that will be just dandy. That's my birthday. So
it sounds like a lovely time. Before we take a break, here I'm going to read the beginning of chapter 4 of John's fabulous book, A Better Goodbye, and something I hope coming to a movie theater near you soon. Onus Dupre Jr. strolled into Skybar on the roof of the Modrian Hotel, and right away started feeling seriously antisocial. Even with the city lights twinkling below on the Sunset Strip and stand-up heaters keeping the customers nice and toasty, he wondered what it would be like to rob the movie stars he rarely saw there but always heard tourists gossiping about. He wondered, too, about making victims of the singers who had just gone platinum and the money changers who were forever inviting presidents and would-be presidents to their big-assed houses for cocktails and campaign contributions. That paragraph chilled me as I was being introduced to Onus Dupree, Jr. We will continue on with John Shulian momentarily. We have about 10 more minutes with my friend John Shulian, a friend and in many ways an idol of mine, one of the finest writers to ever grace the pages of Chicago's newspapers, and that is saying something. Latest chapter of his life comes now. It's his birthday, 71 years old, and he has just published a riveting, entertaining book, a noir, as they say, a better goodbye. It involves four specific characters, one of them Nick Pafko. Where'd you get that last name, John?
Andy wasn't using it. So.
Yeah, I loved it, though. I just want to read one more thing. I hate to do this almost because but I do want people to get a sense of that you ain't lost a step. Chapter 5 begins this way. Kill someone and he never really goes away, not if you have a conscience. Alonzo Burgess had haunted Nick since that night in Oakland, toppled by one last four-punch combination and doomed to hit his head on the bottom rope. The result was the worst kind of whiplash, his brainstem snapping and the lights going out of his life. 14 years later, Burgess still ghosted through Nick's dreams and shadowed his waking hours, and the only time Nick got to come up for air was when trouble found him. Whoa. Trouble does find Nick in this book. The characters, this is kind of the L.A., certainly the L.A. that that tourists don't see, isn't it?
Yeah, we're dealing with the fringes here. I mean, I think there are many more people on the fringes in L.A. than there are in the spotlight. It's just that people don't realize it until they get out here and they get off the bus from Iowa or Tennessee or, you know, seeking stardom, and they say, well, wait, God doesn't give with both hands, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. These, talk about the other, Nick is a fascinating character. Onus Dupree is just in the one paragraph I read before the break, there is such a menace in that paragraph that I was afraid the guy was going to walk around the corner and say, hello, Rick. Jenny Yee is a very interesting character, too, John Shulian. Do you know someone like Jenny Yee?
I do, indeed. I knew about boxers, and I knew about actors.
Yeah.
One of the other characters in the book is Scott Crandall, who's a failed TV star who has turned to pimping to make a living. There's something quite fitting about that.
Yeah, no kidding.
Then there's Onus Dupree. And, you know, and I knew who I wanted Onus Dupree to be, but my massage girl was up in the air because I didn't know any.
Yeah.
And I tried calling a few blindly out of ads in the paper or on the internet. And I got,
you're writing a book.
For a freebie. And then I knew a very, very bright young woman at UCLA. And we were just chatting, and she asked me what I was doing. And I said, I was trying to do some research for this book, but I had sort of run into a dead end. And she said, oh, I know someone like that.
Oh, wow.
And so she put me together with the girl who inspired Jenny, and a girl who had found her job as a masseuse, a sensual masseuse,
mm-hmm.
in the campus paper at UCLA.
Wow.
And she was so bright and so talkative, and she spoke in complete sentences and whole paragraphs. She had a great mind, and she was incredibly cute, and you could see how she would be a big draw in that business.
Sure.
And basically, she told me, she really gave me the groundwork because we could drive along a city street in a nice neighborhood, she could say, well, there were girls in that condo, there were girls in that apartment building, and these are respectable buildings with respectable addresses.
Sure, sure.
And, you know, and then and she'd worked all over. She'd worked in dirtbag places where there were fleas, and, you know, the girls were complaining about getting bitten, and, you know, and she'd worked by herself, which is really... And I don't think she was ever made aware of how dangerous that was because these girls obviously have regulars. But every time she opened her door to a stranger, she did not know who was walking through that door, and she had no line of defense.
Well, that's part of the thing in A Better Goodbye is she doesn't mind the massaging, but she... you know, she does know that world and then decides that she's never going to work without security in her profession.
Yeah, something terrible happens to two girls she's working with.
John, has this novel empowered you in your writing? I mean, is there another novel half finished on your desk is what I mean.
I wish it was half finished. I have what I think is a good idea for what I like to think of as a novel. It's called Lucky Buck. It's set primarily in Los Angeles in the late 40s and early 50s, although it takes us up to the present day. And it's about a kind of life that is no longer possible in this country. It's a very American story, I think, and I don't mean that in a patriotic sense.
Yeah, sure.
But just as... A guy could be a ball player, and a guy could be a cowboy, and a guy could be pretty much whatever he wanted to be in this curious world that my protagonist, Virgil Winrow, whose nickname is Lucky Buck, lives in or lived in. And he has a life he's not sure was worth anything. So he has to... be taught, as probably the readers need to be taught, that there was a life worth living.
Wow, that sounds very, very, very intriguing. You are still, and I know this, I mean, you are still tied to the sporting world in a number of different ways. You write for some online sites. You are often asked to gather stuff into books, including that fantastic football, great writing about the national sport. You must feel as a, because you have such great respect for the, you know, Red Smith and some of the other great columnists who have come before you. Do you worry about the future of, I certainly worry about the future of newspapers, but the future of those kinds of voices, you know, Jim Murray out in L.A., Jerry Holtzman here, you here. Do you worry about those kind of voices finding an outlet when as papers die off?
I don't think those voices exist anymore.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that there's room for them in newspapers, that all the people who put out newspapers or newspapers online is how many hits something gets.
Correct.
And my K-Town column that you were kind enough to
it's one of the most, it's haunted me forever. It's haunted me from whatever year that was, 81. It's one of the greatest paragraphs ever written in the Chicago newspaper, but go on.
And I'm not sure that the editors would let me write something like that because... You know, you couldn't have fun. George Frazier, the great columnist in Boston, used to write about duende, which was an Andalusian word that he said, you understood duende if you knew that Willie Mays had it and Hank Aaron didn't. Miles Davis had it and Harry James didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I could riff on something like that. I could write, when I was going through my papers this past year, I was surprised at some of the things that I found that I'd sort of forgotten about, that I had written what were like little short stories.
Yeah.
In the form of a newspaper column. And boy, that would not fly today. They would say, you know, give us the Bears. We're not enough Bears stuff. And I'd say, it's July. It's July. That's
right.
Okay. Training camp opens in 3 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, give us more Bulls if they're hot. Give us more Blackhawks.
Yeah,
and my feeling was a columnist's job was to help open readers' eyes and make them aware of as much as possible that, you know, you're not an idiot writing a column. You know, you're the summation of what you've learned and observed over all these years,
yeah.
Whether it's music and movies and art and what have you. But you're there to somehow enrich the readers and just make the paper better and broader and livelier and more intelligent, or try to, or at least go down swinging.
Yeah, you, at least in my case, you're certainly preaching to the choir here. Very well put, John. And this new book, his first novel, John Chulian's, I know a lot of people, I used to love that guy, I used to hate that guy. That's what columnists do. His novel you will love. It's called A Better Goodbye. It certainly has all the elements of becoming a good movie sometime, and at least you're not going to fall for, I mean, at least if some producer comes to you, you'll know what they're talking about instead of saying, oh, my God, I can't believe you're going to make a movie of my book. John, let me know the next time you're back in Chicago, or let me know the next time when the next novel comes out, because it was a real pleasure to read, and it's always a great pleasure to talk to you.
Rick, thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate
my,
it.
My great, great pleasure. And you can certainly hold an hour of radio, and I think I think you listeners have gotten a lot out of this. So enjoy the rest of your birthday. You got, it's 8 o'clock out there. You got 4 hours to really go crazy.
I'll put on my party hat right now.
Go jump in a pool or something. John Chulian, take care of yourself.